Caden Community Radio and Heartbeat Silent Sound Systems proudly presents Silent Nights 2015, a silent disco and silent auction benefit for KBOO, December 19th, 8 p.m. at Manifestation PDX. This very special silent disco features talented KBOO DJs and MCs. You'll have three channels of danceable jams to choose from, including bluegrass, the Grateful Dead, reggae, afrobeat, world music, hip-hop, funk and soul, electronic dance music, bhangra, and global bass music. There's something for everyone. We'll also feature a silent auction with art from local artists as well. Silent Nights will be on Saturday, December 19th from 8 p.m. to midnight at Manifestation PDX, 2020 Southeast Bush Street in Portland. For more information on the lineup and tickets and more, go to kboo.fm/silentnights2015. That's Silent Nights 2015, a benefit for our community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Sitting in for Dime Roberts, I'm Sarika Mehta, and this is Stage and Studio. Tony Nandini Aslam is a Bangladeshi-American writer from New York. She's the founder of High Wildflower Botanica, a small batch niche perfume, candle, and skincare line. Her writing has appeared in Elle.com, Fashionista.com, Open City, Women 2.0, Billboard.com, and Gawker. A graduate of Brooklyn College, MFA, and Vassar College, she lives in Brooklyn, New York, and her debut novel is called Bright Lines, and it was published this year by Penguin. Bright Lines is a story of a Bangladeshi-American family finding their way in Brooklyn and Bangladesh. The characters are compelling with many twists and turns along the way in the story. Thony joins me here in studio. Welcome to Stage and Studio.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Sarika.
First, tell us in brief the story of Bright Lines, because I'm always worried about giving away spoilers.
Well, I wanted to write a family story that kind of dealt with this notion of coming of age in a new way, and I wanted to have a parallel coming of age between the father and his two daughters, one biological, one adopted. And I felt like it would be really cool to show all of them kind of flailing and scrambling to find their desire in this one summer of 2003, which was a pretty magnetic time in Brooklyn, and I wanted to capture that vanished Brooklyn that doesn't really exist today.
We're definitely going to talk about that vanished Brooklyn a little bit more, but I wanted to backtrack for a moment. This is your first novel, so tell us the story behind the story. What was its genesis?
I really wanted to write this book probably before I knew what the book would be, and when I was getting my MFA at Brooklyn College, you know, you write short stories, you have workshop. It's kind of like a typical MFA environment. And I remember I had to work while I was in school. I didn't just live off of my loans. So I got a job selling shawls for a Kashmiri merchant in France. It was a very random summer job. And I was working in a hotel and I was reading all these novelists. And I just had this image of the shop owner painting his apothecary, and that image was the first kind of inspiration for Bright Lines. And there's all these Muslim shops on Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn, which is a really vibrant place of commerce, and they're hubs for people of Brooklyn to kind of buy their incense and oils and shea butter. And I thought that was such a great setting to open this story that I wanted to tell. So it was kind of like starting with that scene and how that led into a character who has these demons from fighting in the war in Bangladesh, and how it stays with him even though he's built this really beautiful life in Brooklyn. So it's kind of like the parallel life between the one we live in our inward mind, inner world, versus the one that we live, you know, in our day-to-day life.
And a little bit more about you. Your background in writing is mostly in writing nonfiction pieces about feminism and the garment industry in Bangladesh and immigration and much more. How does your nonfiction work inform your fiction writing?
I really feel like nonfiction is so important in terms of having some sort of writing career online these days. It's very now, and I don't know that I ever foresaw that for myself, but I really fell into kind of these think pieces about issues that are interesting to me. So for the garment industry, you know, kind of writing that I've done, it's really about all these people that are being disenfranchised because of very little pay, very little job security and actual security in terms of being able to survive conditions. And they're the people that kind of run the economy of Bangladesh. I thought that was fascinating to write about. So it kind of took me away from fiction, because getting stories published or, you know, little pieces of fiction published is kind of hard in a way that nonfiction isn't as hard, in my opinion. So it was kind of like, well, this is stuff I really am passionate about and my social justice side really wants to write about, but it's also something that is more available to writers on the internet. So I think it's very much a issue of it being today that I'm writing.
Definitely. And back to your novel, which again is called Bright Lines. The first half of the novel takes place in Brooklyn, and the second half, for the most part, it takes place in Bangladesh. So how did it feel for you to write using these two very unique and starkly different places as the backdrops for your story?
I think that this novel really is so much about place. I mean, setting is incredibly important to me, and I wanted to kind of, with, you know, wide brushstrokes, kind of paint this picture of Bangladesh that I don't think people have necessarily read in fiction. And I think some of the things readers will tell me, or ask me rather, will be, well, we've read like Indian stories about going back to the country, and what do you think you're doing differently? And I'm like, well, it's a different country. And it has a different, you know, set of histories and locales and, you know, topography. And I really wanted to explore that. So it's very researched in terms of the life that grows there. You know, the botanical world that I'm interested in both places is sort of a connective tissue between those two places, because that's what the characters are into, tilling the earth, you know, kind of creating this Edenic environment. Because as beautiful as it is, there's a darker history underneath some of that beauty, you know. So I really felt like place could be stirring and beautiful, but also restrictive and pretty terrifying as well. And I wanted to show that both places are like that, and share the fact that both characters, all the characters, feel at home in both places too.
And one of the difficult portions of this, you know, of the history of the story is the 1971 Liberation War. That's, you know, one of the settings that informs your characters' lives. Mm-hmm. So before we get into that, maybe tell us in brief about the war so that our listeners have some context.
So the war that, you know, is in this novel is the 1971 Liberation War between what is now known as Bangladesh and what is now known as Pakistan, formerly East and West Pakistan. So after partition of India, I mean, we had this huge mess of people, you know, basically in exile from the lands that they had always known. And basically this was a result of that partition. And the truth is, I mean, you have two cultures that are very different that are kind of under the same umbrella of Pakistan. And that was really hard for people in Bangladesh, because they were, you know, demanding to speak their language, to have seats, you know, in government. You know, there was a lot of disenfranchisement. So when there was this like massive mobilization of people and they actually got the seats, there was, you know, a fear on West Pakistan's part about the little guys kind of taking over. And that led to an offensive strike in which many people were murdered at Dhaka University on the night of March 26th. So you have this war that started from an offensive attack, but it was years and years and years of discord and really not seeing eye to eye on what it meant to be Pakistan. So the war is really a fight to have Bangla and Bangladesh. You know, that was like the premise of it. And then, you know, India's involvement in December, actually tomorrow is the anniversary of liberation, but they, you know, helped to win the war. So it's like all the South Asian countries that are now India, Bangladesh, Pakistan, kind of are wrapped up in this history. And I wanted to kind of show it from the point of view of a Bangladeshi character.
And you talked a little bit about this, the pride in the Bangla language and culture. And another recurring event that comes, that is referenced in your story, is the 1952 language war. So maybe give some background on that as well.
Yeah, so again, it's, you know, this is like students fighting for the right just to speak their language, which is such a primordial right, you know, to speak what you were born knowing to speak. And I am just in awe of people in remembering that history of how they had to fight for something that seems so basic to us, you know. So that was really about, you know, the national language. Again, what is nation at that point? You know, nation is East and West Pakistan. So Urdu was the language that was, you know, being proliferated as the national mother tongue. And that's...
of East and West Pakistan.
Of East and West. So, you know, I'm sure in that generation, you know, the struggle is Urdu is a totally different language. I mean, sure, there's similarities between these languages, but nothing alike in terms of script. You know, one's a Devic Ganari script, one's an Arabic script. I mean, they're just very different. And that was a disenfranchisement that felt like, you are not letting me live the way that I deserve to and have the right to live. So that was a bloody, you know, struggle that people died to be able to speak Bangla in, you know, public space.
Yeah, it's incredible. It's just, I mean, South Asia has such a diversity of languages and cultures.
Of course,
as it
yeah.
is. And there has been a lot of bloodshed for it. So totally. I know that you had said that this was a heavily researched story for, obviously, for these reasons, for talking about these different wars and to develop these characters in a authentic way. As I understand it, you yourself had gone to Bangladesh as part of the research. Talk about that trip.
Yeah, so I am not one of those I go every year type of people. That's like not financially possible for me, but I'm one of those every 7 years people. So as I was wrapping up revisions of the novel, you know, you kind of have this moment of not just authenticity, but like, I really don't know if the details that I want to show are there. And I decided that I needed to take a, you know, trip, a last ditch effort to kind of really get into the story. So in March of 2014, I booked a trip with no one. My sister came later, but I was like, I'm just going to go to Bangladesh and go on a road trip to the places that are in this book, which I had actually never been to because I'm not from those places. I'm from the city and like outside of the city. And when I say I'm from there, I'm not from there. My family lives there. So I got bus tickets to Sylhet and Chittagong, north and south. And those are beautiful places that are really, you know, Sylhet's on the border of India. So you can see India from the river. You can see Meghalaya. And Chittagong is, you know, near all the other places that I went to visit that were beachside, kind of like at the edge of the country facing the Bay of Bengal, and also the tribal lands of Rangamati. So there's these three locales that I had described in the book, and they're really places of borderlands, you know, very porous borders between India and Bangladesh, between the indigenous communities, the people who have been very disenfranchised by the majority Bengali population, because that's their you know, language is not Bengali and their religion is not Islam.
And so, it's not even recognized usually.
And it's not recognized. And their land has been, you know, they've been dispossessed of their land because of the building of dams. Very similar issues throughout South Asia, I think, that kind of are very tragic. And I wanted to see that and not just see that, but also see what are the flowers growing? What are the trees growing? What does the sky look like in March? What, you know, like all these things that were very important to my book kind of came alive in that research trip. So I filled my arsenal with details that I think made the novel much richer than it was before I left.
That's definitely true. I mean, this is a rare account of all of the different kinds of South Asian American literature that I've read. This is a rare account that includes a tribal community presence in the story. Mm-hmm. In part, you know, there is a geographical reality to where Bangladesh is. And as you were saying, mm-hmm. You have access to these indigenous mm-hmm. communities. But the fact that it made its way to the book, excuse me, in, I mean, not just as we can see these people over mm-hmm. there, but as involved characters.
I always think India has its arm around Bangladesh because all the like tribal lands of India were these people that are, you know, basically sharing that lineage of the indigenous people in Bangladesh. They live in those countries, you know, in Mizoram or, you know, Assam. Like, all these countries are really, like, I think, just different in terms of what the mainstream narrative of what it means to be Indian is. And it's just like, looks like geographically on a map, it looks like India's arm is wrapped around Bangladesh.
Like buddies.
Like buddies. But those are all borders.
Right.
Between Bangladesh and India, you know, it's kind of fascinating. So the ethnic group in my book, they're the Khasis. And in Bangladesh, they're a minority group, but you literally can cross the river and you'll be in India, you'll be in Meghalaya, and the Khasis are the majority of Meghalaya. That's the land of the Khasis. So it's so different in terms of where you are, you know, which side of the river your foot is on, you know. And there's even a joke in the book of, like, you know, you look across the river and you see the majesty, and it's like India definitely took the prized land, you know, in this whole thing. And there's the lowlands, and then there's the mountains, and then there's so many myths folded into just how people came up with storytelling about the people of the lowlands, the people of the mountains. So I wanted to hear all of that stuff and lace the book with those details that I don't think I've actually read in South Asian fiction yet.
Absolutely. And we definitely get a taste of that in mm-hmm. your book. I was just curious, you know, in your research and in experiencing all of these different communities, excuse me, especially researching these wars, how did it feel to write about something that is pretty deeply ingrained in the history? And it's a painful history, both for the story and for you as somebody who has this in the history of your community and the history of your family, and you're writing it in this intimate way. How did this, tell us about this experience?
I definitely feel like there's a lot of fear and pressure when you're embarking on telling stories that are about a larger group of people that you belong to, and especially when you're talking about something so painful to people. And a lot of people are like, well, why do you need to write about that? Like, people, why do we need to talk about that? And it's like, well, it hasn't been that long. I mean,
no, 1971 wasn't
that
long
ago. It's like, I know people that are that age, you know, like, I have friends that are, you know, that age. So it's like, I just don't think that that's a good argument for not talking about it, because it's clearly still a huge issue in that, you know, we have a huge kind of debate right now in Bangladesh between people that want to have freedom of speech and espouse views that are atheist or feminist, and that's at direct odds with people who are living, you know, very religious lives and are very much, you know, war pro Pakistan during the war. So there's still like a tenor of violent tension that exists, and people are still being murdered for freedom to espouse what they believe. So in that way, I'm always thinking about these issues. But in terms of what this meant for my people, my family, I really wanted to take certain historical truths and then create a new untold truth. I wasn't abiding by anything except maybe dates, you know, just to keep it a little bit consistent. And even that you can mess around with certain aspects of. But one of my favorite examples is when I was on my tour of Bangladesh in March of last year, I remembered seeing watermelon, and watermelon felt like such a beautiful image. It's just fields and fields of watermelon. And I was like, oh, it's so interesting. It's like the stands were selling it and it was in season. And I was thinking, like, well, what if in my scene they're saving these women that are in a house, and, you know, they don't know if the women die in the end because they just take them to the boatmen and tell them to take these women who are being raped by Pakistani soldiers, you know, like, take them to a safe house. But on their way, they crack open a watermelon and give them this food and sustenance that's right outside this house that they've been raped in. And I felt like it was such a, you know, stunning, like, realistic image that I don't know if that happened, but I was like, this is so poignant and perfect for this moment, and that the one thing you want to provide them is like, how can I make you feel better in this horrific time that I'm finding you in? And they just crack open this watermelon and it's like, have this, eat this, like, nourish yourself, have some sweetness in your life. It just felt like those little things would appear to me in scenes that felt like they would make the novel feel like very much its own fictive world, a fictive rendition of a rendering of the war.
It's something we hope happened, and I know it's a challenge in like, writing please. With the backdrop of a war.
Yeah.
I just want to take a moment. If you are just tuning in, you're listening to Stage and Studio. I'm guest host and producer Sarika Mehta. And if you missed any of this show, you can hear it again on stageandstudio.org. I'm chatting with Thunni Nandini Islam about her debut novel, which is called Bright Lines. So we were talking about the backdrop of Bangladesh in your story and the histories that inform the characters' lives. But the first half of the book takes place in Brooklyn, which is your, you know, you're from Brooklyn or you're from another place in New York?
No, I live in Brooklyn. I don't live in that neighborhood anymore, but I did live in that neighborhood at the time the events are in Bright Lines.
Well, you mentioned that the story takes place in 2003 of Brooklyn. And what was so special about that?
I think it was such a vibrant time to be in Brooklyn. You know, 2003 is the year that the blackout happened in New York, and I was in New York in the city when that happened, and it was so cool to just experience that for me. But I know tons of people who had horrible experiences during the blackout, but it felt like, you know, one of those things where in a post 9/11 New York, you still had the communities that represent New York living in proximity to each other. Right now, it's like this really massive gentrification that is a confluence of a lot of factors. Like, things are more expensive. People are choosing to rent out their homes for short periods of time rather than, you know, subletting or letting people have, you know, access to housing. And people are leaving the city en masse, you know. So it was a time where that was a little bit before the wave of gentrification that has taken over. It was kind of like the calm before the storm in a way. So I wanted to really talk about that vivid summertime Brooklyn that is so intoxicating, you know, because we people who live in cold-ish places. Portland would probably count as a place that gets cold. It's pretty cold today. It's like a renaissance that happens every year, you know, that first day where you can wear a dress or show some skin. And I wanted to really capture the renaissance of the summertime, you know, because it goes right back into like the cocoon that we live in. But this is really about opening it up to the many characters that are neighbors and lovers and friends and, you know, are living in these hubs and sharing these, you know, moments in salons and apothecaries. And just like, I wanted to capture that Brooklyn where people said hi to each other. And, yeah, you know, that doesn't exist anymore in the same way. It's pretty sad. And I actually, you know, I did an event last night at Powell's, which was wonderful. And I did a little slideshow presentation because I was presenting alone. So I was like, how do I make this engaging? And I had a slide of this hardware store, a feminist hardware store called Sisters, which is now a bar. That's a she and cute Brooklyn bar. And it's
a little bit different.
Yeah. And there was an audible gasp in the room because they were just like, oh my God, that is totally not a feminist hardware store anymore.
No.
It's like a beautifully lit, like, vibey bar in Brooklyn. So it's just showing how space doesn't even look like that anymore. Yeah. You know, those places aren't there now.
Well, you started to briefly talk about the characters of Bright Lines, who are very compelling. I loved the character, the protagonist, Ella.
Yeah.
Very complex. I mean, she's fascinating for so many reasons, including the fact that she has this condition where she hallucinates as the sun goes down every day.
Yeah.
And it's heartbreaking and fascinating, you know. Tell us about developing her character.
So I definitely wanted to play with these ideas of repression. She's a very repressed person, and not in the Scientology sense, but in like just as a person. She's very tightly wound, and she's an orphan. And I feel like the orphan in literature is something that really fascinates me too, because it's like you have free rein to kind of unlock a person that isn't being parented by their biological parents. And she is being parented by her uncle and aunt, but there is a level of distance that I think is cultural in a way where, you know, it's like you're our daughter, but then it's like, if you don't feel like you're being our daughter right now, you don't have to, you know, do whatever you want. Like, it's kind of like this laissez-faire attitude with her. And she's a responsible and wonderful person, but she also has this real crush on her cousin who she grew up with. So it's like this thing that I was like, it's kind of like, how do I make a character who has this sort of weird, you know, desire moment, like a very lovable but provocative and emotionally stirring person as well. And I feel like the hallucinations came about because I have this, I don't hallucinate, but I do have moments where I have hallucinated and I've witnessed the world in a vivid and colorful and profoundly mind-altering way, you know, just to be perfectly upfront and honest about, you know, these experiences. And I felt like, what if a character had that all the time? So I was researching hallucinations, and there are grooves in the brain that are altered by depression, by a tumor. And I tried clinical approaches to the hallucinations at one point, but it didn't seem like that was the way to go. I think being someone who's been very alienated her whole life, that was reason enough to kind of create another haven, a place of solace, you know, from the real world. And it kind of is something that's out of her control, but it comes in handy in terms of giving her space from some of her emotions that are, you know, tread darkness and depression for much of her life.
And excuse me, I'm recovering from a terrible cold and I keep coughing. Ella is, I mean, this is one aspect of her personality. She's also one of the few queer characters of color in literature. I was about to say South Asian literature, but in literature, period. I mean, this is just one of the very few books I've read that features such characters. And I wondered if it was your intention to address this politically. Did it happen organically? Especially, this wasn't the traditional coming out story.
Right.
So talk about that.
You know, I'm queer. I'm not like ever shy about talking about sex and life and love and politics. Like, those are what I want to think about. So my book is an extension of what I like to think about. It's not really I'm going to write this queer character who goes through a transition. You know, it's like that came organically to this character. And my community in Brooklyn and beyond is a very eclectic queer, trans, people of color community. So it's like, that's my world. Like, I want to write about that world. And I think that, you know, as a person who's always been like a self-proclaimed feminist, it's important for us to write fiction that is liberatory. And, you know, it doesn't have to always be happy endings. And clearly there are not happy endings in this book too. But I wanted to, in some sense, kind of show how vibrant and vivid and loving and lived these lives can be in a way that I don't think we get. You know, it's kind of always like a tragic end to a person's life, you know, when it's like the tragic trans woman character or the tragic, like, you know, repressed sexuality of a woman, you know. And I wanted to kind of show, yes, there's tragedy associated with being who you are, but there's also a lot of vivid, you know, loving examples of it, you know. And in just even in Bangladesh, I mean, the third gender of hijra became a legally recognized gender, and I thought that was like a really beautiful coinciding with, yeah, as you know, lack of progressive things happen all over the world, but that seems like a win, you know. And yeah. I think that it's historically from ancient times a part of South Asian culture to have these trans identities that are totally, you know, part of our, you know, experience. And it's a fallacy to think that it's like, this is a modern take on, you know, it's it's been there forever. We have just, you know, suppressed it and repressed that history and that nuance in terms of how we understand gender. So I think I'm just like tapping into something that exists across the South Asian diaspora, which I've written about. And this is like a trans story that kind of shows a continuum of identity that's pretty infinite, you know, across gender, across, you know, like Muslim identities, across all this different stuff that is very real for me. So it's not like a put on to be, although if people read it that way, I have no control over that. But if you come to a party at my house, it will look like that, you know. So in that way, it's very authentic.
Unfortunately, we are out of time. This is a wonderful conversation.
Yeah, thank you.
Thoni Nandini Islam is the author of Bright Lines. She joined me in studio today, and you have to go check out her book. It's just fascinating.
Thank you.
Really excellent. Thoni, thank you so much for chatting with me on stage and studio.
Fun. Yeah, great.
That's it for Stage and Studio. Thanks to KBOO engineer Janet Anderson. And if you missed any of this show, visit kboo.fm. You can also download shows at iTunes. And don't forget to like us on facebook.com/stage_studio or tweet us at @StageNStudio. Sitting in for Dime Roberts, I'm Sarika Mehta. Thanks for listening.
Thank you to all of our new and renewing members during our winter membership drive. That makes KBOO one of the best community radio stations in the country. We fell a few thousand short of our goal of 55,000, so if you didn't have a chance to give, it's never too late. Remember, for the month of December, if you become a new member or if you increase your giving over last year, your gift will be matched by a number of local businesses and individual donors. Donate now at kboo.fm/give. Thank you once again for being the best supporters a station could ever ask for.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the We Real Cool film series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month is Ornette, Made in America, showing Thursday, December 17th at 7 p.m. Released in 1985, Ornette, Made in America, explores the rhythms, images, and myths of America seen through the eyes of an Ornette Coleman's imagination and artistic evolution over three decades. Again, that's Ornette, Made in America, Thursday, December 17th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.